All right. Well, thank you for being here this afternoon. It's certainly a pleasure to be here myself. My name is Wade Nywert. I am a chemistry professor at Bethel University, about a mile north of Joel in St. Paul, Minnesota. In some ways, I feel a little bit like a fish out of water with this sort of talk, because I even told a few of you as we've had meals that I almost felt a little bit guilty about putting this talk together, because I'm so used to giving chemistry talks where I'm putting spectroscopy and crystal structures and different things, and I've got lots of data and graphs. And I have none of that in this talk, so maybe that's a good thing late in the afternoon on a Saturday. I guess we'll see. So in many ways, I felt like I was putting together a slideshow from my summer travels. So hopefully that will be interesting to you, because what I'm going to talk about is very different than what I do for most of my job at Bethel. And so I'm going to share a little bit about some of my experiences working with students by leading a study abroad course for a general education course that I teach. So first, I want to tell you a little bit about Bethel University, where I'm at. So I told you already, it's just north of St. Paul and Minneapolis. Bethel is, for those of you who aren't familiar, a small liberal arts Christian college, about 2,700 traditional undergraduates, mostly living on campus. And we've got a relatively large science program for the size school we are. So 13 biology faculty, 9 chemists and biochemists, 7 physicists, and just starting an engineering program this coming fall. So we've really had a lot of support from the administration in the sciences. Students are fairly attracted to Bethel because of its science programs. So we're fairly proud of that. We get fairly good students. And so we've got a lot of interesting things going on there. And so one of them, I hope, is this course that I teach. Let me tell you a little bit about myself first. And as I was putting this slide together, initially I put some of the things from my CV. And this is where I got my undergraduate. This is where I went to grad school. I thought, this is more interesting. So this is kind of who I am. So some pictures of my family, my wife, Rachel. She is a historian. She teaches at St. Catherine's University in the Twin Cities. And our kids, Liam and Lucy. You can see they're both supporting my hometown, not theirs. Eugene, Oregon, is where I grew up. So I went to undergraduate at George Fox University in chemistry. But we like to travel. I'm an avid runner. So next to me is Matt Niebergall. He's one of the biochemists at Bethel. So he's gotten me into running. But then the picture on the lower left-hand corner, the picture on the lower right-hand corner are actually pictures from this study abroad course that I teach. So in addition to teaching general chemistry, inorganic chemistry, I teach a thermodynamics and kinetics course, research seminar course. I've had the opportunity to get to develop an interim study abroad course. So Bethel has a fall semester, a Jan term, and then a spring semester. So there's all kinds of different courses taught during this Jan term, and many of them are these short-term study abroad opportunities for students that are led by Bethel faculty. And so initially I was teaching this course on campus as just sort of a history of science, topics in science, and got the opportunity to convert it to a study abroad, and so I took advantage of that. And so hopefully you'll get to hear a little bit about that. So what does this course look like? The general education curriculum at Bethel is tiered all the way through all 4 years of students' education. So it's not just sort of these first 2 years learning some basic skills. So this is actually an upper division. Mostly juniors and seniors are taking this course. So it meets a requirement that we technically refer to as science, technology, and society. So students have to have taken their math course already, and they have to have taken their lab science course already. So it could be any number of different things in terms of which math and which science course they take. So I get all kinds of different students coming in from a variety of different perspectives. Some of them are science majors, some of them are not. I usually end up with about half and half. Although, interestingly, I end up with a large majority of women in my class. So out of the roughly 30 students we take, I've had as few as 3 male students, and 27 women come along. So that's just how it works out. So I told those three guys they had really good odds, and I don't think the women appreciated that, but that's okay. So the cost of the trip, the cost is added on to the students, but it's all inclusive, so it ends up running around $4,200 right now. And then what do we do? What are some of the requirements? So they each have to read three books, and I'll show you a few of those here in a second. But they also have to give a presentation as a group on one of the sites we visit. So I give them a list of maybe 20 or so places that we're visiting and let them choose as a group to sort of be our mini tour conductor, if you will, and just share with us a little bit about what are we going to see, why is this important, how does it fit into the class as a whole. And then they also have to lead a group discussion. This is something I've added over time. Initially, I led all of the group discussions, and then they were expected to engage in those. And it took some time and some willingness on my part to sort of give that over to them. And so now they lead those discussions, and I sort of simply moderate and try not to get in the way. And I was a little bit intimidated to do that at first, but they've actually done a really good job of taking over that and being really responsible and taking that seriously. And then they also journal and blog, and I'm going to spend a good portion of this talk talking about that blog, which is a new addition. And the journal really isn't an accurate description. It's more short writing assignments that are guided. So each day they've got a question specific to the activities that we're doing and the places that we're going and the things that we're talking about, and so they're writing about that. And then I've incorporated this blog, which you'll get to see some excerpts from some of the students' comments about that. And then they write a final paper, turn that in at the end. So I think in order to give you some picture of what this is like and what this is, I want to describe some pieces of the first few days of my first time doing this trip. I think I got in over my head, and I thought this would just be a fun way to get to go to Europe and take students with me. So imagine you're in your, I think I was in my fourth year of teaching at Bethel, so I felt like I got my research program underway, and I'd gotten my classes sort of figured out, and my curriculum, and I've even gotten involved in a little bit of service within the institution. So why I thought I needed to add this onto my plate, I'm not sure, but I take off for Europe with 30 students. I think I had 20 students on the first trip. And we land in Rome. And keep in mind, this was the first time I'd done this. And unfortunately, I had very underestimated the budget. So instead of 42, it was probably like 3,600 per student. So I was already crunched for budget. And I realized I never budgeted in the amount it would take to get from the Rome airport to Rome. So I've already blown my budget on the very first thing that we do in class. I thought, okay, that's fine, we've got room, no worries. I get to Rome, and I walk into the hotel, and it's very clear no one is expecting 20 college students to be walking through the door. They had no record of our reservation, they had no idea we were coming, it's getting dark, it's raining. I'm in a panic. The students thought this was hilarious. They find us a place to stay for a night. We come back here. So now I'm totally blown the budget because now I've paid for three extra nights that I didn't budget for at all. We go to check out of the hotel 3 days later. We had stored our luggage in a closet. They sent the key home with one of the maids. We have to kick the door down to their closet to get our stuff out, rush off to the train station just in time to see it take off for Florence without us. We get to Florence around midnight. We walk 2 miles in the rain to get to our next hostel, which I don't know where it is because I hadn't been there. And I'm thinking, I have made a serious mistake and I won't have a job when I get home. So that's sort of the context of where we're starting this journey together. Now, I have since done this course 7 times. I hope I've improved upon the course. So we'll see what the students' comments are here when we get to the blog. So some of the books that I use, I try to have each student read some type of general survey of the history of science. So two of the most common that I've used in the last few years are Bill Bryson's Short History of Nearly Everything, very, very readable. There's a lot in there that doesn't relate specifically to our content in Europe, but the students enjoy it. I've also used John Gribbin's The Scientists. Very good book. The students complain it's very long with very small font, and they're right. But it's very, very rich, really great. Maybe not as readable as Bryson's book. The other two are science and faith integration texts. And so I've only used the Galileo Connection by Charles Hummel once, and it was a good book. It really looks at sort of controversies within science. And recently I've used Ruth Benkowitz's God in the Lab, How Science Enhances Faith, which we've actually been able to interact with Ruth when we go to Cambridge. And so that's really been great. I think that the students get excited when they get to meet the author of the book that we've been reading for the course of the month. And then the third book the students are reading is related to their group discussion that they're leading. So let me give you a little bit of a picture of what we do over the course of this 3.5 weeks. So we start in Rome. We spend about 3 days there. Many of the things that we do in each of these cities are things that anybody would do if they went to these different cities. So we go to the Colosseum, we go to the Forum, we go to the Vatican Museum. But what I'm asking the students to do is think about all of these visits in the context of the history of science. I want them to think about how these, you know, what were the scientific thoughts at the time that these were built, or that the artwork that they're seeing was made. Or that the science that was being done then, and really thinking about how that interacts with society. And then also trying to sort of, as an umbrella over all of that, think about how faith impacts that, how a Christian worldview is involved. So from there we go to Florence. We usually spend 3 or 4 days in Florence. We go to the Accademia, we go to the Uffizi, we go to more art museums than most of these students have ever been in their lives, which is great. Sometimes we go to Padua, which is where Galileo taught for a while. We spend a short time in Venice, take a very long train to Geneva, where we go to CERN primarily, which many of the students have no idea what CERN is and have zero interest in it. And my hope is that when we leave, they at least learn something and found it very interesting, which is generally true. From there, we go to Lauterbrunnen, and quite frankly, we just go to Lauterbrunnen to go skiing. So it's one of the most beautiful cities in the world. If you've never been, you should go. From there, we go to Munich. So we go to Dachau, which was one of the first concentration camps during World War II that was liberated. They have a great science museum that's comparable to the Smithsonian in Munich. Then we go to Paris, lots of art museums, churches there. And then finally to Cambridge, beautiful, rich history there at Cambridge, certainly with regards to the history of science, and then finally finish in London. So it is a full 3.5 weeks. They are tired when we get done. They are tired along the way. But hopefully they are learning a lot of great things. So I don't have the time to show you everything that we do in all the places. So I wanted to give you just a little flavor. And a few of these are just some pictures. But also, you know, we hear a lot about active learning classrooms or flexible learning classrooms. This is my active learning classroom in January. So this was the 2016 group. So I try to get a picture of each group outside the Colosseum. It's one of our very first days when we're in Rome. We have very non-traditional lecture halls in this course. So sometimes we're packed into a little cubby in the Colosseum. Sometimes I pack 30 students into a room designed to sleep 4 or 5. So I tell the students that you're going to get to know each other. And these are like hour and a half long classes probably sometimes that we're sitting in these rooms, having these discussions and talking about it. And they have an unconventional commute to get to class. So we tend to take up all the train space, and they learn quickly that they are indeed loud Americans. So rather than showing you everything about what we do, I wanted to just use Florence as one example of a city that we go to and some of the things that we do. So one of the things we do in Florence, we're almost always there on Epiphany. Most of my students don't know what Epiphany is. They don't follow the church calendar. So we take them to Mass at Santa Croce, and largely because Santa Croce also is where Galileo's tomb is. Michelangelo's tomb is there as well. So we sit through Mass in Italian, but since it's an Epiphany service, there's actually really common songs, and they can sort of follow along with the bulletin and catch some of the prayers. So I don't know if you can see, it's really hard to see on here, but even Galileo's tomb right here, we got an intersection of science and faith that also is one of the biggest conflicts within science, or perceived conflicts within science and faith. Some suggestions to some of his work with pictures of the moon, the moons of Jupiter, and then down here there's also some studies with laws of motion. So we go to the Uffizi. They see lots and lots of art. So these are two of my favorites, but very, very different. And I'm wanting the students to think about when were these made, why were they made. So we've got the Annunciation on the left. We've got Botticelli's Birth of Venus on the right. And one of the things I try to get them to do is look for the symbols within these, that they might not be an art connoisseur. I certainly don't consider myself to be an expert in art. But looking for things, there's lots of Annunciations. They almost all look exactly like this. Mary's on the right, sitting in a chair. She's got her Bible open up. The angel is kneeling down in front of her. There's almost always Easter lilies there. The Holy Spirit is breathing into her as she finds out she's going to be the mother of Jesus. Right, and then we have completely secular art, and thinking about, you know, why was there this switch? Why was it all religious and then secular? And how did that impact the way that things were going with regards to science? Also in the Uffizi is one of Michelangelo's only paintings that's been kept. So a Holy Family, and just when they see that, it's hard to see this just out of context of all the others, but it's very, very bright. It's vivid. I mean, he was a master of color and form, seeing the musculature. So Mary is pretty ripped in this picture. Seeing some of the geometry as well, and having them go and see Michelangelo at the Accademia, or sorry, David at the Accademia, and having them think about, do you think Michelangelo knew anything about anatomy and about science? And they very clearly come to the conclusion, well, of course, look at the veins, look at the musculature. So they definitely get that exposure there. One of the lesser known museums that we go to is the La Specola Wax Museum. La Specola is just Natural History Museum in Italian. This was actually the inspiration for Body Worlds, if you ever saw that as it was touring around the country and saw the wax models. These are all wax models of human cadavers. So it took about 13 years to make each of these, and it took about 100 bodies for doctors and scientists to study and artists to study to be able to generate each of these. And this is a whole wax museum just filled with samples of different anatomical studies. So these are some of the whole body ones, whether we're looking at the musculature or the nervous system or the organs. And so this is fantastic. And one of our contacts in Florence, both at La Specola and also at the Museo Galileo, is a woman by the name of Karen Giacobassi. And she has just been a fantastic fountain of information, a really great friend at this point now. And she takes our whole class under her wing and just takes us through Florence. She books everything for me and makes it much, much easier. And so the Galileo Museum is also one of the highlights within Florence. So you get to see some of Galileo's original telescopes. There's very few museums that we visit where you get to see the original items made by the people that we would know and associate with different discoveries. Some of his original lenses, so his original lens in this frame here. Some of his original manuscripts, or at least early copies. And then, interestingly, some of his fingers. So I actually had a student write her final paper about the scientific reliquaries that we saw. So we see Newton's hair in Cambridge and different things. So she compared that to the reliquaries that we see at some of the Catholic churches. So they've got some of his teeth there and some fingers, and it's very strange, but certainly a highlight for the students. So we go through these cities, we see all these different things. One of the new additions that I've added, so in 2016, I kept a blog simply because I had so many people back home, whether it was at Bethel, at church, friends, family, wanting to keep track of us and know what we were up to. So the first one, bethelchemprof.wordpress.com, is my own blog that I kept in 2016. And I quickly realized I was not going to keep the blog by myself anymore. It was super time consuming. I spent about 2 to 3 hours a day working on the blog and uploading pictures and crafting the text. So I made an assignment for the students in 2017. So historyofscience2017.wordpress.com is the student blog. And I put, I think, an entry or two. The other professor, which happened to actually be my father-in-law, he put a couple entries. But most of them are the students. And so what I want to talk about for the remainder of this is the students' comments. And I took some excerpts from the blog for different students. And I've got a bunch of them in here. We might not have time for all of them, but I'll pick and choose a handful of them. Because one of the things that I've found, sort of not necessarily planned for, is that this class has really blossomed students' ability, or at least willingness, to engage in issues of science and faith. So it started out as simply a general education course that I thought would be fun to teach in Europe as opposed to sitting in the bitter cold of Minnesota during January. And it's really burgeoned into a larger discussion of science and faith, and really gotten students that normally would not have engaged in this conversation to really grapple with some tough questions. So I'm just going to go through. I normally would not read off of my slides, but these are the students' comments, which I had not obviously memorized. So these were comments by Lexi, who's on the left. They always love taking pictures of their food. I don't really understand that, but lots of pictures of them eating. But we enjoyed some more crepes from a local stand, which brought back waves of nostalgia from Paris. I think it's safe to say we've all consumed our body weight in those delicious treats. So they get to eat very well on this trip. So I included this next statement so if we weren't for those two guys teaching on this subject, that would be me and my father-in-law. I would have fallen asleep before you could finish saying quantum. I didn't add that to sort of toot my own horn and sing my own praises, but actually for my father-in-law. My father-in-law is a Lutheran pastor in Tacoma, Washington, and it's been really, he's taught this course with me four times. The students really gravitate towards hearing him talk about science. And I think that says something very important about pastors and our churches talking about science, which they often tend not to. And I think that also says something about Christian colleges and higher educators speaking about it. They expect me to talk about science. They don't expect the Lutheran pastor to talk about science. So Lexi finishes by saying, whether or not patterns or direct relationships are visible to the human eye doesn't mean they are not present. Ralph is my father-in-law, discussed how we also see this concept when we view the Trinity. Each part is equally God, but each forms a unique relationship with humans. So one of the things, the only prompt I gave them for this blog entry was simply I wanted it to be reflective of what they'd learned. So they could have written simply, you know, talked about the history of science. They could have talked about a museum we went to, a tour we went on. And it boggled my mind how many of them talked about science and faith. So this is Emily. And the titles here are the titles they gave their blog entry for that day. So she was reflecting on our discussion on the mechanistic view of the universe. And she says there are positive and negative effects to the clock analogy. Positively, it acknowledges that God is the creator. However, it takes away the personal relationship with God and implies that he doesn't play an active role in our lives. In other words, we don't need him to continue living as we are. This, friends, is false. We do need God in our daily lives. We need his love, mercy, protection, and much more. So I was encouraged by the fact that she was willing to be bold about sort of stating her opinions and say what she thought. So Emily is hoping to be a math teacher. So this is from Sam. So Sam is there on the left-hand side with his elbow on the table. So the picture at the bottom, Sam and I got to ski in Lauterbrunnen together. So we spent a day skiing. And as a physics major, I was really surprised to read this quote from Sam. I don't often think of my physics and engineering students as the one contemplating beauty. But he says, what makes beautiful things beautiful, and why are we so compelled towards beauty? I think this appreciation for things that we consider beautiful signals something primitive. Humans have an innate appreciation for discipline, energy, and talent. We feel heightened emotions when we acknowledge such characteristics. We recognize and appreciate the creation process that lies behind the product. We're always looking for something that gives priority to our souls rather than our physical needs. So it was really uplifting to me to see a student talk eloquently about something that seems so far afield from their area of study. So this is Haley. She's holding up a little ceramic thing that was in a cake that our host in Paris served us when we got there. She almost broke her tooth on it and then got a little crown to reward her for finding the special piece in the cake. And so she says, we realize the importance of community. This trip would be so difficult to do by yourself without being surrounded by strangers that turned into dear friends. Something the core of what Bethel would like us to know at the end of our time there is how our passions and callings are able to point to God. Science and faith have only recently had diverging paths, but it's so relieving to know that this parting of ways was only recently, that science, religion, and philosophy were braided together in the academy.
Where are we at with time?
Okay, so I'm going to skip here. To this, so this is Beth. She's there in the middle, sitting on the stool. And so she said a favorite pastime on this trip was to pose a question, which everyone would take turns answering. So this is what they would do on the trains and at meals. And this was super encouraging to me. I mean, I would love it in my chemistry classes if my students told me that later they spent an hour and a half talking about chemistry concepts and problem solving at lunch. So far, I've not gotten that feedback. But here, they do. So these were some of the responses that she got to, what have you learned about yourself and how will your life look different when you return? I learned that it was worth it to try new experiences out of my comfort zone. I tend to be a homebody and I'm proud of myself. When I get back, I want to go out and explore Minneapolis more. Somebody else said, I learned that a career in science is very compatible with faith. Many scientists in the past and many today are Christians. I'm not alone. I loved slowing down to visit with others at mealtime. Actually remembering to slow down and taking the moment is so important. I want to apply this at home. So it was really encouraging to see students talk about these different things. So I'll jump to this last one. This is Keith on the far left. So I try to get a picture of all of my engineering and physics students in front of the CERN sign when we go. They seem to be the most excited. I think it's one of the few times the other students see the physics students giddy. So that's always fun for them. So he and Tyler has a look back. While all of the journal questions and class discussions were science related, most ended up being tied back to our faith in some way. I believe that is what made this trip so amazing. Any class can travel to Europe and hit up all the main attractions, but our experiences went so much deeper. Many of the questions triggered conversations which lasted hours outside of class time with other students. The course caused us to question our presumptions of both faith and science and to dig for truth in all areas of our life. So I put this one last just because I felt like this sort of epitomized what I want students to take away from an experience where I'm trying to get them to think about the integration of science and faith. So just to wrap things up, some of the future steps, right, as I've sort of worked through this, now I want to evolve this into something bigger, a larger project. So a few of the things that I'm going to work on is developing some surveys, pre and post trip, trying to get them to really trying to identify what is it I'm doing well, what is it I'm not, because I don't even necessarily always know exactly what's prompting these kinds of comments. And then we have a hard time with all the different books. They do a lot of reading. They probably read over 1,000 pages for this course. Which during a one-month course is pretty substantial. So developing some sort of course-specific reader, integrating some primary sources, and also some specific things associated with the places we go. Lastly, I want to thank you for being here. Thank Ralph, so he's on the left. I tired him out. Thank Trey, he's one of the other co-instructors that I teach with. I tired him out. Thank the International Studies Office for supporting this course and also supporting my travel here, and thanking the ASA for letting me come out and share a little bit about. So we've got a little bit of time for questions, it looks like. So if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer. Yes, in the back.
Is this a graded class?
It is. Yep, so one of the policies at Bethel, that you could use to be able to take these courses pass-fail before I started at Bethel, and basically they found students with the means were simply taking them as a means of getting to Europe or Belize or Ecuador or Africa or wherever they're going. So now you have to take them for a grade so the students are engaged. I've had guests come along. I had an adjunct professor join us, and I required her to participate in all the class discussions and tours, and so that was fun to have her along. Yes?
So, from what I understand in your first couple slides as far as your core curriculum, you have a requirement that they take a lab science and this kind of integrated type mm-hmm. of science.
Yep.
So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I really like that. Yeah. I mean, I really like the way that Bethel has sort of tiered their gen ed curriculum. Instead of thinking, well, we're just going to teach some basic skills in freshman and sophomore courses, and then they should just focus on their major. Right. they've really integrated this out. So this is a 300-level course. You've got it, and most of them wouldn't have those first two courses done, especially non-science majors, until well into their junior or senior year. So
this would be a better, I mean, what you're trying to do, it's better for mature students.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think, I mean, just the logistics of the travel with the younger students and sort of the responsibility issues, there's a big difference between my freshman students and what we could talk about and the way we would interact and sort of what I'd go off and let them do on their own versus my juniors and seniors. So,
so what are like some other examples of classes that are in this kind of category?
So there's usually other classes in this particular category. So that there's a couple other study abroads during January that so we letter all of our gen eds as a K course. So one goes to Ecuador and the Galapagos Islands and is an environmental biology course. And there's another one actually that just started from the biology department that goes to Africa and looks at similar issues. There's one from our biokinetics program that goes to Belize and is looking at sort of holistic medicine and ideas. So I give them a bad time and tell them to just go and do yoga on the beach, but they say they're doing other things, so I assume they are. So there's those as study abroads, but there's others. There's a physics professor that teaches a conflicts in science course on campus during the break semester. There's one on AIDS, there's one on cancer. So they're trying to help students take what they've learned in their lab course and integrate it into a larger context and understand why is science important, why should we bother knowing about this. So we'll take one last question, I think, then we're going to be out of time.
How do you deal with having issues with a group that size and fitting the washer breaks in and making their washers just not very practical?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's one of the things that it's taken me some time to figure out. I think one of the main complaints I get in my evaluations is that I walk too fast and then I never give them time to eat. And I would say that I do walk too fast. I intentionally, it's hard for me to slow down for them. And it took me a long time to figure out how long it takes 30 people to walk across the city, because I seem to be able to do it much, much faster than they can. But we try to meet monthly before we go and talk through some of those logistics. So I try to encourage, I mean, one's just trying to get to know each other, but letting them know, if you need something, you have to communicate it to me, because if no one tells me something, then I assume everything is fine. And so trying to develop some rapport before we even go. I usually know 10 to 15 of the students beforehand, so that helps a little bit. But it really is, I mean, the biggest piece of advice I give them is that they have to be willing to adapt. Almost no day goes as planned, right? Something gets fouled up. When we're in Florence, there's a huge Epiphany parade, and you can't get from one side of the city to the other. And so I tell them, like, if you get stuck on the wrong side of the parade and you can't get to the Uffizi, you're not going to the Uffizi. And so that's the other thing, is I put a lot of responsibility on the students. And I tell them, I mean, the very first thing I do when we get to Rome is I teach them how to use the train passes and the train systems and say, if you miss a train on a day we're going to a new city, it's your responsibility to get to the next city by yourself. I haven't had that experience, but I've had students not get off the train and have to figure out how to get back. So they seem to think it's going to stop for a half hour, 45 minutes, it stops for, you know, 60 seconds. So and they're always surprised, you know, when students didn't get off the train, they go, what are we going to do? We're going to go get lunch because I'm hungry. Should we call the police? No, I don't think we're going to call the police. We'll just wait for these two students to come back from Bologna. So it happens. I think they're very surprised that I'm not more worried.
Thank you very much. Thank you all.